Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. Another attempt to redraw Wisconsin's congressional maps is thrown out. Plus, the Department of Justice is ordered to release a list of every Wisconsin cop. And another liberal judge enters next year's race for Wisconsin Supreme Court. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for May 1st. I'm Ani Van Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Welcome to Rewind. Big week this week. A lot of stuff out of the courts in many different directions. So we will start with the latest redistricting lawsuit to get thrown out by a three-judge panel. So this is now the second one that this has happened. It's a lawsuit from Law Forward. It was a different type of challenge. The last one was about partisan gerrymandering. This one argues that it's an anti-competitive gerrymander. The three-judge panel said that it's essentially a partisan gerrymander argument, and they said, like, only the Supreme Court can rule on this. What do you make of this?
So, remember, the Supreme Court has changed a lot since 2022, obviously. But in 2022, the court basically picked maps for legislature and congressional offices. In that decision, they said we're not dealing with partisan claims. Like, they're not justiciable in court. That's the standard. So now the Supreme Court now has a liberal majority. Probably doesn't agree with that standard, but that standard hasn't changed yet. Remember, in the legislative case that the court threw out the old maps, it wasn't about partisanship. It was about municipal islands. Basically, these legislative districts had territory that was not contiguous to the district. That's not allowed. Okay, so these three-judge panels say, you appointed us Supreme Court and gave us no direction whatsoever. Republican lawmakers, 2011, you drew this law up that says if there's going to be a challenge to a map, you have to have a three-judge panel to review it, gave us no direction whatsoever. So we're not sure what to do, where authority is, but we do know the Supreme Court said that you cannot do a partisan gerrymandering argument, essentially, or take that up. So long as that's the law of the land, we can't do this. And oh, by the way, the anti-competitive argument is basically functionally the equivalent. It's the same thing. It's about partisan makeup of these districts. Ergo, we're punting. Now what I'm watching is, what does the state Supreme Court do? Interestingly, Mark Elias is the attorney in the partisan gerrymandering case. Hasn't said a peep since the court punted his lawsuit saying we're not doing this. Can't happen. Law Forward, the day right away, filed an appeal with the state Supreme Court and has now filed a request for an expedited process. They basically want everything done, oral arguments and briefing, by the end of this term, which ends July 31st. Now, this term really ends probably in June. They're done with the decisions by the oral arguments and decisions by June. So I'm not sure how it's going to work, if it will. But they want maps possibly in place by 2020. That's been the goal for Law Forward all along. There's going to be a trial in this one, remember, in 2027. Elias wanted new maps this fall. That window is closed. But now I'm watching, okay, what's the state Supreme Court do? And here's the nice little, like, sidebar to all this. If the court doesn't act, if it doesn't draw new maps, you can bet Democrats would have a trifecta after this fall. If they have both House of Legislature and the governor's office, there will be a new map in Wisconsin that will probably be at least 4-4, if not better, for Democrats, especially after what the Supreme Court did, U.S. Supreme Court did this week out in D.C. Basically, I don't want to say it gutted the Voting Rights Act, but it really took a big chunk out of it, narrowed it significantly. Well, in Wisconsin, Democrats have not wanted to touch the Milwaukee-based 4th District because it is a district that's produced a black lawmaker and Gwen Moore. Now they're going to go, oh, we can look at this Milwaukee district, split Milwaukee in half along I-94, take the south part of Milwaukee, gather Racine, Kenosha, southern suburbs of the city, then take the north side of Milwaukee and grab this, this, and this, and we got two Democratic districts. Then we got Madison as an anchor for, like, districts 3 and 4. Can we get really aggressive? We need a fifth one out of, like, the Fox Valley. So, yeah, it's going to be a wild, wild west if they can draw a map on their own come 2027.
Yeah, one of the things that could be taken up, you know, if the Supreme Court considers this, is this question of the anti-competitive gerrymander and whether that is functionally different than the partisan argument. Doug Poland of Law Forward said essentially that. He said this is the first anti-competitive gerrymandering case ever filed in Wisconsin courts, and it deserves to be heard. So really trying to kind of make that separate argument. Of course, Will on the other side saying three-judge panel got it right. Mm-hmm. This is
precedent. This is the law of the land.
Yeah.
So then also a bunch of lawsuits were decided for now against the Department of Justice. So two different decisions, but both having to do with open records. We've been talking a lot about open records lately. One of them from a lawsuit from the Badger Project here in Wisconsin and the Invisible Institute in Chicago. They were requesting a list of every cop in the state, and the DOJ had said no to that. A court ruled that they have to release that. And then on sort of the other side of things, the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce had requested records from the DOJ. The DOJ took like a year and a half to release them, and so a court's now saying that they can ask for attorney's fees and legal fees because of that lawsuit. What do you make of both of these challenges? It's a little bit DOJ kind of playing both sides of open records laws.
Josh Call sometimes has a reputation for being very deliberate in how he does things. I would argue too slow. Open records requests, conservatives have a big complaint with Call about how quickly he fills them, how he's pursuing these things. My findings were the appeals court decision. So the court required, the circuit court required Call to release these documents about communications with a law firm, I believe it was. And Call argued their attorney-client privilege, can't turn them over. So the court says, you got to do that. But it said, you know, we're not comfortable ordering you to do pay damages and stuff because we're not sure we can do that. The appeals court unanimously said, yes, actually, you should have a trial about this, or at least a hearing about this, whether you should pay damages and attorney's fees. I think at most, WMC says it will go after $100 in damages and $1 in attorney's fees.
Yeah.
So it's not really about the money, it's the principle. But still, for a Call, if you're going to be an open records advocate, not a great look to have these things happen on your watch.
Yeah, and then as for the list of police officers, what they're asking for is name, employment history, badge number, and ages. And I think the project that they're working on is an investigative project looking at wandering law enforcement officers. Mm-hmm. So this idea that a cop found, you know, guilty of wrongdoing in one state or one jurisdiction can go to a different one, sort of not have that record reflected. Josh Call has argued that this opens, you know, undercover officers up to potential exposure, that it could be really dangerous. WPPA, the police union, said that this will endanger officers. I would expect this to be appealed. And so it'll be interesting mm-hmm. just to sort of watch both of these move forward. More court news. U.S. attorney recommendations. So we have this, you know, bipartisan nominating panel for the Western and Eastern districts of Wisconsin. And they finally came to some sort of consensus on who to nominate. So they are putting forward, I'm going to get this name wrong, Peter Smyzak, is that what we decided? And Chadwick Elgersma. Elgersma for the Western District, Smyzak for the Eastern District. And this comes after this kind of Brad Schimmel as the interim in the Eastern District, but Baldwin and Johnson kind of came together and put forward their names. What do we know about these guys?
Big news is that Schimmel's not on that list. Yeah. So Smyzak is already in the office currently. He and Elgersma, basically the nominating commission, they applied the first time. So this commission, made up equally of appointees from Ron Johnson and Tammy Baldwin, has to reach consensus. You have to have five of the six members agree on anybody for them to be the next step to be working in the White House. The first time they applied, they didn't get five of six. Somehow, between then and now, now they got five of six. The guess is that Johnson and Baldwin said, hey guys, take a look at this because we don't have confirmed U.S. attorneys in either district. So now we've got two. Elgersma, interesting. So he was appointed interim by then U.S. DOJ AG Pam Bondi. The judges there in the Western District extended his appointment beyond 120 days. So we're happy with you. Eastern is where all the drama has been. So with no confirmed appointee, Bondi made Schimmel the acting U.S. attorney. The judges in the Eastern District said, we don't like this so much. We're going to cut this off. But then Bondi went, I'm going to make him the assistant first U.S. attorney. That'll basically put him functionally in charge of the office, and he can still run the show. There are all kinds of questions about that legally. If, for example, somebody's been charged by the office with Schimmel in charge, they might say, hey, he's not legally appointed. I'm going to challenge my criminal charges. Watch for that. But what's interesting is, depending on what happens here, he can still stay with the office even if this guy is confirmed by the U.S. Senate, which is never a given, but, you know, consensus here, Ron Johnson, Tammy Baldwin, both happy, probably a good sign. Or, of course, you also have the Trump appoint the person, so don't forget that part. But if he's confirmed, Schimmel could stay in the office, still work as a prosecutor, just not be in charge. Mm-hmm. So kind of still a soft landing for Schimmel. despite like Tim Abel being very unhappy that he's in that office right now.
Yeah, and he talked about, you know, this getting to be kind of a swan song position, you know, for him to retire on. It's a little bit different if you are not the U.S. attorney. But it was also interesting to see Johnson and Baldwin kind of putting out statements that they were both fairly happy with how this went after a somewhat rancorous first attempt mm-hmm. to fill that. And then as for one other court where we might see somebody new, or we will see somebody new, we have a new candidate in the Supreme Court race for next April. So I stress that we now have two candidates 11 months out from the election who are in. This is Pedro Colon. He is a Milwaukee judge. He was a former lawmaker. And immediately upon getting into the race, he received an endorsement from Justice-elect Chris Taylor. He will be up against, for now, Lindsay Burnett, who is a Clark County judge, more of a prosecutor background. And so in some ways, they're kind of representing, right, these two different mm-hmm. strains that we have seen in the Supreme Court, the kind of lady prosecutor wing, if I can say that, Kurofsky, Protasiewicz, Crawford, Dalit, and then the more kind of activist, advocate, lawmaker in Chris Taylor. What do you make of this new announcement?
Well, what lesson do you take from the April election, right, is the lesson that Chris is the new model, that you can be more partisan because voters want to hear partisanship out of their judicial candidates. You'd go for Pedro then. Mark Pocan, for example, endorsed Pedro on Thursday, so getting more Democratic endorsements? Or is a model so tried and true that you want not just female prosecutor, but sitting judge who has that experience? Also, Lindsay got elected as a Democrat in Clark County as DA, not very common in red parts of Wisconsin. So the big questions now are, one, do conservatives have a candidate? Right now, the answer is no. I have been calling and calling and calling and calling, and nobody's heard a single name that's real just yet. They throw names out there, but they don't really have somebody that says, okay, this person's going to run. Two, what are we going to see financially from Pedro and Lindsay? So we're going to get a report mid-July. Now, Susan Crawford got in by early June of 2024 for the 2025 race. Chris Taylor's in by early mid-May in 2025 or 2026. So yes, these guys are early, but there's a pattern evolving here of like everything starts earlier. Both of those candidates, Taylor and Crawford, had six-figure hauls immediately in their first reports. What do we see from Lindsay and Pedro? That might give some hint about who's stronger financially and who might people gravitate toward as this thing winds on. The other thing you're going to watch for, Pedro's from a power base for liberals, Milwaukee. Lindsay's not from any power base for Democrats or even a population base for anybody. But can she make inroads and have some kind of a infrastructure for this primary in February the year through? Now, the nightmare for conservatives is no conservative candidate. You got two guaranteed liberals emerge from the February 2027 primary, and that's it. That guarantees you a 6-1 liberal majority, depending on how liberal it is. I don't want to get there this yet. I wouldn't count that happening. But it's be interesting to see, once push comes to shove, the money, the infrastructure, the endorsements, you know, who's more organized. Pedro passed on running in 2026 when Taylor ran, and 2025 when Crawford ran. Now, he and Chris both came out right away in 25 saying, hey, I'm thinking about running. Did they have an agreement of like, hey, I'm farther ahead, Chris Taylor. Pedro, you may be able to wait your turn. And now Chris is like, hey, you know, you helped me a lot. You endorsed me, so I'm going to return the favor. But either way, watch those money reports in July. Watch the infrastructure and the endorsements. Where do Democrats gravitate toward? I'll tell you what they're hungry for in terms of candidate next spring.
Yeah, I also had that question of whether a conservative would get in. And when I talked to sort of the consulting folks in the Republican side of things, they say absolutely somebody will get in. And also that they don't really envy whoever it is who does get in, because the advantage just has been for liberal candidates. And I think what we're seeing right now, too, is kind of a splitting of what type of liberal judge do voters want. It's also interesting, when Taylor got into the race last year, all three sitting liberals and Justice-elect at the time, Crawford, backed her immediately. But this time she was alone in backing Pedro, and so it'll be interesting to see if the other three come out and for who, or if there will be a division among liberals on the court after mm-hmm. having this kind of united front for so long, while they were sort of in the minority and the scrappy underdogs They are no longer the scrappy underdogs. All right, for other election news, but now moving towards electoral politics and not courts, you have been talking about this possibility that somebody new will get into the first congressional district race, and that happened. Peter Bergalis, this alder from Milwaukee, formally announced his candidacy, as we've talked about before. He lives outside the district. He serves on the Common Council for Milwaukee. There are other Democrats who are running in that district, but nobody who's really performing very well, raising much money up against Brian Stile, who is a fundraising powerhouse. So what does it tell you that this new guy has jumped in?
Yes, he wants to win in 2026, but I think there's an eye on 2028 on a couple of factors. So one, it's interesting. So Peter is now an elected official in the field. There are questions, can he raise $1 million quickly? That would be pretty impressive. So all eyes now to see, can he raise a much money? Because Mitchell Berman, I think, is the leading candidate from Democrats, financially at least, hasn't raised a whole lot of money so far. I don't want to dismiss six figures, but doesn't cut it in this day and age when it comes to politics.
And when Brian Stile has $5 million in the bank.
5.6, you want to be technical. But yeah, so, okay, Peter, if the environment is bad enough for Republicans, and it's bad right now, as we sit here today, gas is $4.30 a gallon coming in the office, that's not great. Donald Trump's numbers, not great, but we still have some time until the fall. If it's bad enough, anything can happen. But you've got a guy in Milwaukee trying to appeal to voters in Janesville and Beloit. I'm not sure that's going to work. But 2028 might be a different seat. So we talked earlier about the lawsuits and Democrats. So there might be a new map in 2028. So for Peter, this might be, okay, this is a down payment on a race in 2028. I get my name out there, infrastructure, the seat changes. It has more of a Milwaukee emphasis. I'm actually in the district. Instead of having to worry about Janesville and Beloit, I've got south side of Milwaukee suburbs, Racine, Kenosha. I can live with that kind of a district. Also, if Peter wins the primary and is a real challenge to Stile, he could do the Democratic Senatorial Committee a big solid by forcing Stile to spend some of his money, because Ron Johnson, I know it's a ways ahead, but hasn't said he's going to run for a fourth term in 2028. If Brian Stile wins in 2026, he's a front runner to replace Johnson in 28 if Johnson's a run. Democrats would love to see some of that 5.6 million go down to like 2 or 3 million. That'd be awesome for them to keep him from being too far ahead. So, again, eye on 28, both new map and maybe a different field of candidates if Stile was looking at the U.S. Senate. Again, a long way away, has to win this fall. But we saw some polling this week from a conservative group. I think it put out for 9 seats around the country. Trump's upside down, the first district. He won it by 4.5 points in 24. Not great. Stiles up by 9 points on Mitch, but I think 78% of voters didn't know who Mitch was, and he's still down 9. Probably tells you there's just some discontent. Stiles' job approval is like 38, 31, 36, 31, so not huge, but a little bit of warning signs there about what's happened the first. It's a slightly Republican-leaning district. It can be got in the right environment. Not sure this is the right environment just yet. It could be, though.
Right. One of the points that Peter has made is that, you know, they need Democrats who can also get the level of national money and attention that Stile and Republicans are able to get there. But right now, national Democrats are really focused on the third, and that's where sort of all the money is going. So sort of a question of whether Peter Bergalis, yes, he does hold elected office, but it's local elected office in Milwaukee. Does he have that Rolodex in D.C.? So it remains to be seen. More updates out of the legislature, more Republican retirements. In the Assembly, Dean Kaufert of NEA. And then in the Senate, we found out today, Andre Jacques is retiring. And he, this is one of my favorite fun facts, is one of the most prolific lawmakers. He just gets tons and tons and tons of bills passed. We don't talk about many of them because they are a lot of the sort of highway naming and, you know, utilities kind of stuff. But he is at least 1 year passed the most bills of anyone in the legislature. So he is the 6th Republican now to retire from the Senate. What does that tell you?
So look at the Senate caucus. It's now a third of the caucus is not running for re-election. Doesn't sound a great signal about their feelings of how confident they are in retaining the majority this fall. Two, Jacques' seat is not competitive. It is deep red. But 3 of the 4 incumbents who aren't running were in competitive seats. Republicans don't have those right now. They've got a world of hurt. Senate right now, as we sit here today, things can change, money, environment, et cetera. In the Assembly, while there have been all these retirements so far, Dean's the first one in a competitive seat. Everybody else is like deep red. Robin Voss's seat, not competitive. Scott Allen's not competitive. They're all pretty red. This one, though, as they call it, a majority maker. So 54-45 Republican majority. There are five members of the assembly, Republicans, who have seats that Kamala Harris took more votes than Donald Trump. Dean's one of them. Dean had been in the assembly before. He left in 2014, became mayor of Neenah. He came back and won by like 200 or 300 some votes, close race. Him not being there makes it that much more difficult. Now we're watching Jesse Rodriguez down in the Milwaukee suburbs, another majority maker. Is she going to run again? Haven't heard yet for sure. I've asked a couple times, but haven't heard back yet. The other ones include Todd Novak over in Dodgeville, another kind of Dem-leaning seat. Ben Franklin up in the Green Bay area. So Ben's running, Todd's running, but without those two, it makes just life more difficult for Republicans in the Assembly to hold that in chamber this fall.
And I think one way that we are seeing some confidence among Democrats, certainly when it comes to the Senate, is that there is going to be some Democratic primaries, mm-hmm. which is a little bit unusual. So one that we just found out about in the 17th Senate District, so that's Howard Markline's district, but it has become newly competitive after the redrawing of the maps. So Jenna Jacobson of the Assembly has kind of been the anointed Democratic favorite for several months now. She has the backing of the Senate Campaign Committee. But then just now, Kern Hendrickson, who many of us as reporters know as this advocate for child care, has been really involved in that kind of policy advocacy for the last several years, announced her run. And so she will be challenging Jacobson. And I think it'll just be really interesting to see what does that actually do for that race, and then how confident are they that a Democrat is going to boot out Markline, right, this mm-hmm. very powerful Republican, such that they are comfortable kind of having a potentially tricky primary race.
Corinne had filed a while ago. The fact that she's not left and is announcing is probably a sign that she's really committed. Over in the 5th Senate District, there was a similar situation where the Senate Democrats, as a caucus, basically got behind Robin Vining, a member of the Assembly from Wauwatosa. Another candidate who had run before, a different office, I think, got in, but then went, nah, not my time. The fact Corinne's sticking around tells you that she's like, you're not pushing me out of this thing. So now, yeah, it's also a question of resources. Will it drain resources, key resources, that you could use for against Markline instead? That's something to watch.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting. And then a little bit of almost breaking news, let's say. And I guess I should mention that we are taping this on Thursday. People will be watching this on Friday. So if news broke overnight, don't at us. but the Wisconsin Elections Commission just made a decision in a meeting just a couple moments ago that Madison has to redo its canvas from the spring. They have to throw out 23 absentee ballots that the clerk's office delivered late. So what is going on in the Madison clerk's office? And then what happened at this meeting?
Madison has some problems. So in the fall, they didn't discover 193 ballots that had been turned in. Like they just lost track of them. That was not good. This time, they had 23 absentee ballots that they had in their possession on Monday, before the day before the election, but didn't get them to the polling site by 8 p.m. State law says you have to have absentee ballots in the hands of the counter, basically, by 8 p.m. to be counted. Madison said, we're going to count them anyway. The commission said, that's no good. So now this order basically results in Madison having to redo its canvas. It applies the Dane County Board of Canvas and Madison. You got to toss out these 23 and then do your canvas over again. Now it's interesting because Ann Jacobs is the Democratic appointed chair. She's just like, I'm astounded by this entire thing. I hope somebody challenges these 23 voters, our decision. I feel bound by the law. You have to throw these ballots out. I don't think the sins of the clerk should be put on the shoulders of the voters. So hopefully they'll sue, and courts will say no. If it's a mistake by the clerk, you're not going to punish the voter. Don Millis, Republican, basically said, hey, we have to have accountability here. I'm afraid that, yes, this election wasn't very close, but if you have a future election and there's no incentive to get it right, you're going to mess up and really cost somebody a race. And Mark Thompson, another Democrat appointee, he's the one person who voted against booting these 23 ballots, said, I don't like this. I don't read the law that way. We shouldn't punish the voter. Okay. Now, Mequon, also an interesting situation. The clerk there, so now the standard is for all these court cases and everything else, is if you are a clerk and you can reasonably figure out from the information on the absentee ballot envelope where a witness lives, you should count it. So five witnesses did not include their zip code or their state on their signature for the absentee ballot. The clerk said, well, if I can find a second city with the same name anywhere in the country, I can't tell for sure where you live. I can count your ballot. The commission said, that is not the standard. We have told you guys before, if you don't have to have that information, if you can really figure out where they're from, you can Google an address. right, in the city and figure out, oh, that's a legitimate address in this city of whatever. So now MEC wants to redo its canvas and add those five ballots in for its final count. So, yeah, more not great looks for local officials if you're going to mess up stuff like this. What's it going to mean for a big election like November when we could have 3+ million people voting?
Right. All of these administrative details are often sort of the foundation for a lot of these challenges in the bigger elections. That brings us to the stock report. Rising this week is ad spending.
So there's a group, Kinetic, I think, that did a study. They are projecting $370 million in advertising, just in advertising, in Wisconsin's midterm election. That is doubling what it counted in 2022. Now, there's a range, high and low. But they're saying this is the ballpark figure. Again, I should have bought a TV station 25 years ago. It would have made really good financial sense. The other thing that's interesting is they're talking about $1 billion, that's right, $1 billion spent in Michigan. Michigan has a competitive governor's race, a competitive Senate race, and a couple House seats in addition to the legislature. Poor us, just a governor's race and that's it. Now, don't forget, Ad Impact, which also tracks advertising, counted more than $200 million in the U.S. Senate race alone in 2024. It just shows you the cost of things are going up all the time. I keep thinking money is a finite resource in politics. It is not. It seems like it's almost limitless. But yeah, it's getting expensive in a race around here.
Well, and speaking of, mixed is Jesse Eben, who currently is sort of the recipient of a split in the Uline family.
So Dick Uline is pro-Michael Alfonso. He gave this PAC, Northwoods Future PAC, $1 million, along with Sean Duffy, who's leftover campaign funds, to give this PAC helping his son-in-law, you know, as well. Well, now Liz Uline is giving $1 million to a PAC helping Jesse Eben, the Northwoods PAC, not to be confused, the Northwoods Future PAC. Now, I don't know about your personal relationships and how you do your money, but my wife and I could not do $1 million competing checks. Like, it's not in my allowance every week. I know, surprising. I'm fascinated by the Ulines in general, like how they do this. Like, is there like a joint account for the mortgage and like their own personal accounts for their campaign spending? But either way, this is a big deal for Eben because she didn't have the resources before to compete with what's going on for Alfonso. But it's not enough by itself to beat Alfonso in the primary. People tell me, unless two things happen. One, she gets more money, a lot more. Or two, Kevin Hermaning drops out. Kevin Hermaning is a financial advisor, former Marathon County GOP chair, was also a 20-year-old Marine in the 1970s, taken hostage at the U.S. Embassy in Iran. Really compelling life story. He's put $1 million on money in the race, but he's not spent any of that money yet, any real significance yet. So if you have a split anti-Alfonso vote, it makes it harder to win. Remember when Paul Waskin dropped out a little while ago? He was making the calculation of that he needs $3.5 to $4 million in a split environment to win. So million's great. But does Liz have a second or a third million? Diane Hendricks gave money, another mega donor, Republicans, to Eben, you know, an individual contribution. Does she have money to help out with this PAC? Jesse works for Ashley Furniture. Does anybody executive of that company have money to help out the PAC? So lots of unknown questions. But Alfonso keeps skipping local events, local debates. It's not helping his cause. The local saying, you're being this Nepo baby, essentially, getting help from your father-in-law to win this seat. So is there an opening there? Probably. But it would help Jesse a lot to have a narrower field? Absolutely.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of frustration with this idea, sort of like the red carpet being rolled out. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite recent quotes from a political scientist that I spoke to said, Wisconsin voters insist on being sort of untraceable, untrackable. And so, you know, the kinds of things that are appealing, especially to up north voters who want sort of that authenticity, it'll be really interesting to see. Following this week, data centers.
So we had Manitowoc County voted to implement a moratorium on them. I don't know how many were going up in Manitowoc County at all, but it's just a sign of like the pushback. We also saw Wisconsin Watch got a memo from March, I believe it was, a couple of Democrats, of the cost of the data center sales tax exemption. It's roughly lost $2 billion in lost revenue. Now, in manufacturing in general, Wisconsin, we have a philosophy of taxing that we're not going to tax inputs into an output. Like, we tax the actual product made. You could argue the same true for a data center. We're not going to tax the inputs into the center, but we're tax the outputs of it. That said, it's not helping the perception of these things are like getting a sweetheart deal. They're mysterious. They're dangerous. We're talking about AI all the time and having all these fears about it. It's not a great environment. Again, I will say, which candidate for governor can best, I'll say, capitalize upon, but really embrace this issue and connect with voters on it? I'm really watching that in the governor's race.
Yeah, absolutely. And that will do it for Rewind this week. I am Anya Van Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
See you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, Your Week in Review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.